looking for Chris and Andre. At first she thought to look in the tents ranged beyond the field, but there were only men, knights and squires and pages, in that area, and she decided against it. This was a different world. Violence was in the air, and she felt a constant sense of risk. Nearly everyone in this world was young. The knights who swaggered about the field were in their 20s or early 30s, and the squires mere teenagers. She was dressed in ordinary fashion and clearly not a member of the nobility. She had the feeling that if she were dragged off and raped, no one would take much notice. Even though it was midday, she found herself behaving the way she did in New Haven at night. She tried never to be alone, but to move with a group. She skirted around the clusters of males, giving them wide berth. She made her way behind the bleachers, hearing the cheers of the crowd as the next pair of knights began to fight. She looked into the area of tents to her left. She did not see Merrick or Chris anywhere. Yet they had left the field only minutes before. Were they inside one of the tents? She had heard nothing in her earpiece for the last hour. She assumed it was because Merrick and Chris had worn helmets which blocked transmission. But surely their helmets were off now. Then she saw them, a short distance down the hill, sitting by a meandering stream. She headed down the hill. Her wig was hot and itchy in the sun. Perhaps she could get rid of the wig and just put her hair up under a cap. Or if she cut her hair a little shorter, she could pass for a young man, even without a cap. It might be interesting, she thought, to be a man for a while. She was thinking about where to get scissors when she saw the soldiers approaching Merrick. She slowed her pace. She still heard nothing in her earpiece, but she was so close, she knew she should. Was it turned off? She tapped her ear. Immediately she heard Chris say, "We disgraced him?" And then something garbled. She saw the soldiers push Chris toward the castle. Merrick walked alongside him. Kate waited a moment, then followed. Castelgar was deserted, shops and storefronts locked, its streets echoing and empty. Everyone had gone to the tournament. It made it more difficult for her to follow Merrick and Chris and the soldiers. She had to drop farther back, waiting until they had gone out of a street before she could follow them, hurrying ahead at a near run until she caught sight of them again, then ducked back around a corner. She knew her behavior looked suspicious, but there was no one to see it. High in one window, she saw an old woman sitting in the sun, eyes closed. But she never looked down. Perhaps she was asleep. She came to the open field in front of the castle. It, too, was now deserted. The knights on prancing horses, the mock combats, the flying banners were all gone. The soldiers crossed the drawbridge. She followed after them. She heard the crowd roar from the field beyond the walls. The guards turned and shouted to soldiers on the ramparts, asking what was happening. The soldiers above could see down to the field. They shouted answers. All this was accompanied by much swearing. Apparently, bets had been made. In all the excitement, she walked through, into the castle. She stood in the small courtyard known as the Outer Bailey. She saw horses there tied to a post and unattended. But there were no soldiers in the bailey. Everyone was up in the ramparts, watching. She looked around for Merrick and Chris, but did not see them. Not knowing what else to do, she went through the door to the great hall. She heard footsteps echoing in the spiral staircase to her left. She started up the stairs, going round and round, but the footsteps diminished. They must have gone down, not up. Quickly, she retraced her steps. The stairs spiraled downward, ending in a low-ceiling stone passage, damp and moldy, with cells along one side. The cell doors were open, no one inside. Somewhere ahead, beyond a bend in the corridor, she heard echoing voices and the clang of metal. She moved cautiously forward. She must be beneath the great hall, she thought. In her mind, she tried to reconstruct the area from her memory of the ruined castle she had explored so carefully a few weeks earlier. But she did not remember ever seeing this passageway. Perhaps it had collapsed centuries before. Another metal clang and echoing laughter, then footsteps. It took her a moment to realize they were coming toward her. Merrick fell back into soggy, rotting straw, slippery and stinking. Chris tumbled down alongside him, sliding on the mush. The cell door clanged shut. They were at the end of a corridor with cells on all three sides. Through the bars, Merrick saw the guards leaving, laughing as they went. One said, "Hey, Paolo, where do you think you are going? You stay here and guard them." "Why? They are not going anywhere. I want to see the tourney." "It is your watch. Oliver wants them guarded." There was some protesting and swearing, more laughing, and footsteps going away. Then one heavy-set guard came back, peered in through the bars at them, and swore. He wasn't happy. They were the reason he was missing the show. He spat on the floor of their cell, then walked a short distance away to a wooden stool. Merrick could not see him anymore, but he saw his shadow on the opposite wall. It looked as though he was picking his teeth. Merrick walked up to the bars, trying to see into the other cells. He could not really see into the cell to the right, but directly across from them, he saw a figure back against the wall, seated in the darkness. As his eyes adjusted, he saw it was the professor. 30 hours, 51 minutes, 9 seconds. Stern sat in the private dining room of ITC. It was a small room with a single table, white tablecloth, set for four. Gordon sat opposite him, eating hungrily, scrambled eggs and bacon. Stern watched the top of Gordon's crew-cut head bob up and down as he scooped the eggs with his fork. The man ate fast. Outside, the sun was already climbing in the sky above the mesas to the east. Stern glanced at his watch. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. The ITC technicians were releasing another weather balloon from the parking lot. He remembered that Gordon had told them they did it every hour. The balloon climbed quickly into the sky, then disappeared into high clouds. The men who had released it didn't bother to watch it go, but walked back to a nearby laboratory building.
"How's your French toast?" Gordon said, looking up. "Rather have something else?"
"No, it's good," Stern said. "I'm just not very hungry."
"Take some advice from an old military man," Gordon said. "Always eat at a meal, because you never know when your next one will be."
"I'm sure that's right," Stern said. "I'm just not hungry." Gordon shrugged and resumed eating. A man in a starched waiter's jacket came into the room. Gordon said,
"Oh, Harold, do you have coffee ready?"
The man in the jacket said, "I do, sir. Cappuccino, if you prefer."
"I'll have it black."
"Certainly, sir."
"How about you, David?" Gordon said. "Coffee?"
"Non-fat latte, if you have it," Stern said. "Certainly, sir." Harold went away. Stern stared out the window. He listened to Gordon eat, listened to his fork scrape across the plate. Finally, he said, "Let me see if I understand this. At the moment, they can't come back. Is that right?"
"That's right."
"Because there is no landing site."
"That's right."
"Because debris blocks it."
"That's right."
"And how long until they can come back?" Gordon sighed. He pushed away from the table.
"It's going to be all right, David," he said. "Things are going to turn out fine."
"Just tell me, how long?"
"Well, let's count it off. Another 3 hours to clear the air in the cave. Add an hour for good measure. 4 hours. Then 2 hours to clear the debris. 6 hours. Then you have to rebuild the water shields."
"Rebuild the water shields?" Stern said.
"The three rings of water. They're absolutely essential."
"Why?"
"To minimize transcription errors."
Stern said, "And what exactly are transcription errors?"
"Errors on the rebuild, when the person is reconstructed by the machine."
"You told me there weren't any errors, that you could rebuild exactly."
"For all intents and purposes, we can, yes, as long as we're shielded."
"And if we're not shielded?" Gordon sighed.
"But we will be shielded, David."
He glanced at his watch.
"I wish you'd stop worrying. There's several hours more before we can fix the transit site. You're upsetting yourself needlessly."
"It's just that I keep thinking," Stern said, "that there must be something we can do. Send a message, make some kind of contact." Gordon shook his head.
"No, no message, no contact. It's just not possible. For the moment, they're entirely cut off from us, and there's not a thing we can do about it."
30 hours, 40 minutes, 39 seconds. Kate Erickson flattened herself against the wall, feeling damp stone on her back. She had ducked inside one of the cells in the corridor, and now she waited, holding her breath, while the guards who had locked up Merrick and Chris walked back past her. The guards were laughing, and they seemed in good humor. She heard one of them say, "Sir Oliver was sore displeased with that an odor, to make a fool of his lieutenant. And the other one was worse. He rides like a flopping rag, and yet he breaks two lances with Tete Noir." General laughter. "Sooth, he made a fool of Tete Noir. For that, Lord Oliver will take their heads before nightfall. Else I miss my guess he will chop their heads before supper. No, after. The crowd will be larger." More laughter. They moved down the corridor, their voices fading. Soon she could hardly hear them. Now there was a short silence. Had they started back up the stairs? No, not yet. She heard them laughing once more, and the laughter continued. It had an odd, forced quality. Something was wrong. She listened intently. They were saying something about Sir Guy and Lady Clare. She couldn't really make it out. She heard, "much vexed by Our Lady," and more laughter. Kate frowned. Their voices were no longer quite so faint. Not good. They were coming back. Why, she thought. What happened? She glanced toward the door, and there, on the stone floor, she saw her own wet footprints going into the cell. Her shoes had been soaked from the grass near the stream. So had the shoes of everyone else. And the center of the stone corridor was a wet, muddy track of many footprints. But one set of footprints veered off toward her cell, and somehow they had noticed. Damn! A voice. "When does the tourney draw closed?" "By high noons. Faith, and it is nigh finished. Lord Oliver will haste to sup and prepare for the archpriest." She listened, trying to count the different voices. How many guards had been there? She tried to remember. At least three. Maybe five. She hadn't paid attention at the time. Damn. "They say the archpriest brings 1,000 men-at-arms." A shadow crossed the floor outside her door. That meant they were now on both sides of the cell door. What could she do? All she knew was that she couldn't let herself be captured. She was a woman. She had no business here. They would rape her and kill her. But, she reflected, they didn't know she was a woman. Not yet. There was silence outside the door, then a scuffling of feet. What would they do next? Probably send one man into the cell while the others waited outside. And meanwhile, the others would get set, draw their swords, and raise them high. She couldn't wait. Crouching low, she bolted. She banged into a guard as he came through the door, hitting him at knee level from the side, and with a howl of pain and surprise, he fell backward. There were shouts from the other guards, but then she was through the door. A sword clanged down against stone behind her, spitting sparks, and she was running up the corridor. "A woman! A woman!" They ran after her. She was in the spiral staircase now, going up fast. From somewhere below, she heard the clank of their armor as they started up after her. But then she had reached the ground floor, and without thinking, she did the immediate thing. She ran straight into the great hall. It was deserted, the table set for a feast, the food not yet laid out. She ran past the tables looking for a place to hide. Behind the tapestries? No, they were flat to the wall. Under the tablecloths? No, they would look there and find her. Where? Where? She saw the huge fireplace, the fire still burning high. Wasn't there a secret passage out of the dining room? Was that passage here in Castelgar, or was it in Laroque? She couldn't remember. She should have paid more attention. In her mind's eye, she saw herself wearing khaki shorts and a polo t-shirt and Nike sneakers, moving lazily through the ruins, taking notes on her pad. Her concerns, to the extent that she'd had any at all, had been to satisfy her scholarly peers. She should have paid more attention. She heard the men approaching. There was no more time. She ran toward the 9-foot-high fireplace and stepped behind the huge gilded circular screen. The fire was blazing hot, waves of heat radiating against her body. She heard the men coming into the room, shouting, running, looking. She crouched behind the screen, held her breath, and waited. She heard kicking and banging, the clatter of dishes on tables as they searched. She could not make out their voices clearly. They merged with the roar of the flames behind her. There was a metal clang as something fell over. It sounded like a torch stand, something big. She waited. One man barked a question, and she heard no reply. Another shouted a question, and this time she heard a soft answer. It didn't sound like a man. Who were they talking to? It sounded like a woman. Kate listened. Yes, it was a woman's voice. She was sure of it. Another exchange, and then the sound of clanking armor as the men ran from the room. Peering around the edge of the gilded screen, she saw them vanish through the doorway. She waited a moment, then stepped from behind the screen. She saw a young girl of 10 or 11. She wore a white cloth that wrapped over her head, so only her face showed. She had a loose sort of dress, rose-colored, that came almost to the floor. She carried a gold pitcher and was pouring water into goblets at the tables. The girl met her eyes and just stared. Kate waited for her to cry out, but she did not. She just stared curiously at Kate for a moment and then said, "They went upstairs." Kate turned and ran. Inside the cell, Merrick heard the blare of trumpets and the distant roar of the tournament crowds drifting in from one of the high windows. The guard looked up unhappily, swore at Merrick and the professor, and then walked back to his stool. The professor said quietly, "Do you still have a marker?" "Yes," Merrick said, "I do. Do you have yours?" "No, I lost it about 3 minutes after I got here." The professor had landed, he said, in the forested flatlands near the monastery and the river. ITC had assured him this would be a deserted spot, but ideally situated. Without going far from the machine, he could see all the principal sites of his dig. What happened was pure bad luck. The professor landed just as a party of woodcutters was heading into the forest to work for the day, their axes over their shoulders. They saw the flashes of light, and then they saw me, and they all fell to their knees, praying. They thought they had seen a miracle. Then they decided they hadn't, and the axes came off their shoulders. The professor said, "I thought they were going to kill me, but fortunately I knew Occitan. I convinced them to take me to the monastery. Let the monks settle it." The monks took him away from the woodcutters, stripped him, and searched his body for stigmata. "They were looking in rather unusual places," the professor said. "That's when I demanded to see the abbot. The abbot wanted to know the location of the passage in Laroque. I suspect he's promised it to Arnaud. Anyway, I suggested it might be in the monastic documents." The professor grinned. "I was willing to go through his parchments for him."
"Yes."
"And I think I have found it."
"The passage?"
"I think so. It follows an underground river, so it is probably quite extensive. It starts in a place called the Green Chapel, and there is a key to finding the entrance."
"A key?"
The guard gnarled something, then broke off, speaking for a moment. Chris got up, brushing the damp off his hose. He said, "We have to get out of here. Where is Kate?" Merrick shook his head. Kate was still free unless the shouts from the guards he'd heard down the hallway meant that she'd been captured. But he didn't think they'd caught her. So if he could make contact with her, she might be able to help get them out. That meant somehow overpowering the guard. The problem was that there was at least 20 yards from the bend in the corridor to where the guard was sitting on his stool. There was no way to take him by surprise. But if Kate was within range of their earpieces, then he could... Chris was banging on the bars of the cell and shouting, "Hey, guard! Hey, you!" Before Merrick could speak, the guard stepped into view, looking curiously at Chris, who had reached one hand through the bars and was beckoning him. "Hey! Come here! Hey! Over here!" The guard walked up to him, swatted Chris's hand, which extended through the bar, and then broke into a sudden fit of coughing as Chris sprayed him with the gas canister. The guard wobbled on his feet. Chris reached through the bars again, grabbed the guard by the collar, and sprayed a second time right in his face. The guard's eyes rolled up in his head, and he dropped like a rock. Still holding on, Chris's arm banged against the crossbars. He yelled in pain, then released the guard, who fell away from the bars and collapsed in the middle of the floor, far out of reach.
"Nice work," Merrick said.
What's next?
You know, you might help me, Chris said. You're very negative. He was down on his knees, reaching through the bars to his armpit, his hand grasping outside. His outstretched fingers could almost reach the guard's foot. Almost, but not quite. 6 inches from the sole of his foot. Chris stretched, grunting. If only we had something, a stick or a hook, something to pull him.
It won't do any good, the professor said from the other cell.
Why not?
He came forward into the light and looked through the bars. Because he doesn't have the key.
Doesn't have the key? Where is it?
Hanging on the wall, Johnston said, pointing down the corridor.
Oh, shit,
Chris said. On the floor, the guard's hand twitched. One leg kicked spasmodically. He was waking up. Panicked, Chris said,
What do we do now?
Merrick said, Kate, are you there?
I'm here.
Where?
Just down the corridor. I came back because I figured they'd never look for me here.
Kate, Merrick said, come here, quickly.
Merrick heard her footsteps as she ran toward them. The guard coughed, rolled onto his back, then propped himself up on one elbow. He looked down the corridor and hastily began to get to his feet. He was on his hands and knees when Kate kicked him, snapping his head back, and he fell onto the floor again. But he wasn't unconscious, only dazed. He started to get up, shaking his head to clear it.
Kate, Merrick said, the keys.
Where?
On the wall.
She backed away from the guard, got the keys on a heavy ring, and brought them to Merrick's cell. She put one key in the lock and tried to turn it, but it didn't turn. With a grunt, the guard threw himself at her, knocking her away from the cell into the center of the room. They grappled, rolling on the floor. She was much smaller than he was. He held her down easily. Merrick was reaching through the bars with both hands, pulling the key out of the lock, trying another. It didn't fit either. Now the guard was straddling Kate, both hands around her neck, strangling her. Merrick tried another key. No luck. There were 6 more keys on the ring. Kate was turning blue. She made rasping, choking sounds. She pounded her fist on the guard's arms, but her blows were ineffectual. She punched at his groin, but his surcoat protected him.
Merrick shouted, Knife! Knife!
But she didn't seem to understand. Merrick tried another key. Still no success. From the opposite cell, Johnston yelled something in French to the guard. The guard looked up and snarled a reply, and in that moment, Kate brought her dagger out and slammed it into the guard's shoulder with all her strength. The blade didn't penetrate the chainmail. She tried again and again. Furious, the guard began to pound her head against the stone floor to make her drop the knife. Merrick tried another key. It turned with a loud creak. The professor was shouting, Chris was shouting, and Merrick flung the door open. The guard turned to face him, getting to his feet, releasing Kate. Coughing, she swung the knife at his unprotected legs, and he yelled in pain. Merrick hit him twice in the head, very hard. The guard fell on the floor, not moving. Chris unlocked the door for the professor. Kate got to her feet, color slowly returning to her face. Merrick had pulled out the white wafer and had his thumb on the button.
Okay, we're finally all together.
He was looking at the space between the cells.
Is this big enough? Can we call the machine right here?
No, Chris said. It has to be 6 feet on each side, remember?
We need a bigger space. The professor turned to Kate. You know how to get out of here? She nodded. They started down the corridor.
30 hours, 21 minutes, 2 seconds.
She led them quickly up the first flight of spiral stairs, feeling a new confidence. The fight with the guard had somehow freed her. The worst had happened, and she had survived. Now, even though her head was throbbing, she felt calmer and clearer than before. And her research had all come back to her. She could remember where the passages were. They came to the ground floor and looked out into the courtyard. It was even busier than she had expected. There were many soldiers, as well as knights in armor and courtiers in fine clothes, all returning from the tournament. She guessed it was about 3 in the afternoon. The courtyard was bathed in afternoon light, but shadows had begun to lengthen.
We can't go out there, Merrick said, shaking his head.
Don't worry. She led them upstairs to the second floor.
then quickly down a stone passageway with doors opening to the inside, windows on the outer side. She knew that behind the doors were a series of small apartments for family or guests. Behind her, Chris said, "I've been here." He pointed to one of the doors. "Claire is in that room there." Merrick snorted. Kate continued on. At the far end of the corridor, a tapestry covered the left wall. She lifted the tapestry. It was surprisingly heavy. And then began to move along the wall, pressing the stones. "I'm pretty sure it's here," she said. "Pretty sure?" Chris said. "The passage to take us to the rear courtyard." She reached the end of the wall. She couldn't find a door. And she had to admit, looking back along the wall, that it didn't appear as if there was a doorway anywhere in this wall. The stones were smoothly and evenly mortared. The wall was flat, with no bulges or indentations. There was no sign of any additional or recent work. When she put her cheek against the wall and squinted along the length, it seemed all of a piece. Was she wrong? Was this the wrong place? She couldn't be wrong. The door was here somewhere. She went back, pressing again. Nothing. When she finally discovered it, it was by pure accident. They heard voices from the other end of the corridor, voices coming up the stairwell. When she turned to look, her foot scraped against the stone at the base of the wall. She felt the stone move. With a soft metallic clink, a door appeared directly in front of her. It only opened a few inches, but she could see that the masonry had concealed the crack with cunning skill. She pushed the door open. They all went through. Merrick came last, dropping the tapestry as he closed the door. They were in a dark, narrow passageway. Small holes in the wall every few yards allowed faint light to enter, so torches were not necessary. When she had first mapped this passage along the ruins of Castelgar, Kate had wondered why it existed. It seemed to make no sense. But now that she was here, she immediately understood its purpose. This wasn't a passage to get from one place to another. It was a secret corridor to spy into the apartments on the second floor. They moved forward quietly. From the adjacent rooms, Kate heard voices, a woman's and a man's. As they came to the small holes, they all paused, peered through. She heard Chris give a sigh that was almost a groan. At first, Chris saw only a man and woman silhouetted against a bright window. It took a moment for his eyes to adjust to the glare. Then he realized that it was Lady Claire and Sir Guy. They were holding hands, touching each other intimately. Sir Guy kissed passionately, and she returned his kiss with equal fervor, her arms around his neck. Chris just stared. Now the lovers broke, and Sir Guy was speaking to her as she stared intently into his eyes. "My lady," he was saying, "your public manner and sharp discourtesy provoke many to laugh behind my back, and talk of my unmanliness, that I should tolerate such abuse." "It must be so," she said, "for both our sakes. This you know full well. Yet I would you were not quite so strong in your manner." "Oh, so, and how then? Would you chance the fortune we both desire? There is other talk, good knight, as you know full well. So long as I oppose marriage, I share those suspicions that many harbor, that you had a black hand in my husband's death. Yet if Lord Oliver forces this marriage upon me, despite all my efforts, then no one can complain of my regard. 'Tis true?" "'Tis true," he said, nodding unhappily. "Yet how different is the circumstance if I show you favor now," she said. "The same tongues that wag will soon whisper that I too was party to my husband's untimely end, and such tales will quickly reach my husband's family back in England. Already they are of a mind to retake his estates. They lack only the excuse to act. Thus Sir Daniel keeps a watchful eye upon all I do. Good night. My woman's reputation is easily defiled, never to make repair. Our sole safety lies in my unbending hostility towards you.
So I pray you tolerate what slurs may vex you now, and think instead upon your coming reward.
Chris's jaw dropped open. She was behaving with exactly the same intense intimacy, the warm glance, the low voice, the soft caresses on the neck that she had used with him. Chris had taken it to mean he had seduced her. Now it was clear that she had seduced him.
Sir Guy was sulky, despite her caress. "Then your visits to the monastery? I would you visit there no more."
"How so? Are you jealous against the abbot, my lord?" she teased him.
"I say only, I would have you visit there no more," he said stubbornly.
"And yet my purpose was strong, for whoever knows the secrets of Laroc commands Lord Oliver. He must do as he is asked to gain the secret."
"God's truth, lady. Yet you did not learn the secret," Sir Guy said. "Does the abbot know it?"
"I did not see the abbot," she said. "He was abroad."
"And the magister claims to know not?"
"'Tis so, he claims. Yet I will ask the abbot again, perhaps tomorrow."
There was a knock on the door and a muffled male voice. They both turned to look. "That must be Sir Daniel," he said.
"Quick, my lord, to your secret place."
Sir Guy moved hastily toward the wall where they were hidden, pulled aside a tapestry, and then, as they watched in horror, he opened a door and stepped into the narrow corridor alongside them. Sir Guy stared for a moment, and then he began to shout, "The prisoners! All escaped! Prisoners!" The cry was taken up by the Lady Claire, who called out in the hallway. In the passage, the professor turned to them. "If we're separated, you go to the monastery. Find Brother Marcel. He has the key to the passage, okay?" Before any of them could answer, the soldiers came running into the passageway. Chris felt hands grab his arms, pull him roughly. They were caught. 30 hours, 10 minutes, 55 seconds. A solitary lute played in the great hall while servants finished setting out the tables. Lord Oliver and Sir Robert held the hands of their mistresses, danced as the dancing master clapped time, and smiled enthusiastically. After several steps, when Lord Oliver turned to face his partner, he found that her back was turned to him. Oliver swore.
"A trifle, my lord,"
the dancing master said hastily, his smile unwavering.
"As your lordship recalls, it is forward, back, turn, back, and turn, back. We missed a turn."
"I missed no turn,"
Oliver said.
"Indeed, my lord, you did not," Sir Robert said at once. "It was a phrase in the music which caused the confusion."
He glared at the boy playing the lute.
"Very well, then."
Oliver resumed his position, held out his hand to the girl.
"What is it, then?" he said. Forward, back, turn, back."
"Very good,"
the dancing master said, smiling and clapping the beat.
"That's it. You have it now."
From the door, a voice said, "My lord." The music stopped. Lord Oliver turned irritably, saw Sir Guy with guards surrounding the professor and several others.
"What is it now?"
"My lord, it seems the magister has companions."
"Eh? What companions?"
Lord Oliver came forward. He saw the Enoter, the foolish Irisher who could not ride, and a young woman, short and defiant-looking.
"What companions are these?"
"My lord, they claim they are the magister's assistants."
"Assistants?"
Oliver raised his eyebrow, looking at the group.
"My dear magister, when you said you had assistants, I did not realize they were here in the castle with you."
"I was not aware myself," the professor said. Lord Oliver snorted.
"You cannot be assistants." He looked from one to the other. "You are too old by 10 year, and you gave no sign you knew the magister earlier in the day. You are not speaking sooth, none of you."
He shook his head, turned to Sir Guy. "I do not believe them, and I will have the truth. But not now. Take them to the dungeon." "My lord, they were in the dungeon when they got free."
"And they got free? How?"
Immediately he raised his hand to interrupt the reply.
"What is our most secure place?"
Robert de Care slipped forward and whispered,
"My tower chamber. Where I keep Mistress Alice?"
Oliver began to laugh.
It is indeed secure. Yes, lock them there.
Sir Guy said, I will see to it, my lord. These assistants will be surety to their master's good conduct. He smiled darkly. I believe, Magister, you will yet learn to dance with me.
The three young people were dragged roughly away. Lord Oliver waved his hand, and the lutist and the dancing master departed with a silent bow. So did the women. Sir Robert lingered, but after a sharp glance from Oliver, he too left the room. Now there were only servants setting the tables. Otherwise, the room was silent.
So, Magister, what game is this?
As God is my witness, they are my assistants, as I have told you from the start, the professor said.
Assistants? One is a knight.
He owes me a boon, and so he serves me.
Oh, what boon?
I saved his father's life.
Indeed. Oliver walked around the professor. Saved it how?
With medicines.
From what did he suffer?
The professor touched his ear and said, My Lord Oliver, if you wish to assure yourself, bring back the knight Merrick at once, and he will say to you what I say now, that I saved his father, who was ill with dropsy, with the herb arnica, and that this happened in Hempstead, a hamlet near to London, in the autumn of the year past. Call him back and ask him. Oliver paused.
He stared at the professor.
The moment was broken by a man whose costume was streaked with white powder, who said from a far door, My lord!
Oliver whirled. What is it now?
My lord, a subtlety.
A subtlety? Very well, but be quick.
My lord, the man said, bowing and simultaneously flicking his fingers. Two young boys raced forward with a tray on their shoulders.
My lord, the first subtlety. Hazlitt.
The tray showed pale coils of intestines and an animal's large testicles and penis. Oliver walked around the tray, peering closely.
The innards of the boar brought back from the hunt, he said, nodding. Quite convincing.
He turned to the professor.
You approve the work of my kitchen?
I do, my lord. This subtlety is both traditional and well executed. The testicles are particularly well made.
Thank you, sir,
the chef said, bowing. They are heated sugar and prunes, if it please. And the intestines are strung fruit, covered with a batter of egg and ale, and then honey.
Good, good, Oliver said. You will serve this before the second course?
I will, Lord Oliver.
And what of the other subtlety?
Marchipan, my lord, colored with dandelion and saffron.
The chef bowed and gestured, and more boys came running with another platter. This held an enormous model of the fortress of Castelgar, its battlements 5 feet high, all done in pale yellow, matching the actual stones. The confection was accurate down to small details, and included tiny flags from the sugary battlements.
Elegant, well done, Oliver cried.
He clapped his hands with pleasure, delighted as a young child for the moment.
I am most pleased.
He turned to the professor and gestured to the model.
You know the villain Arnaud lies fast upon our castle, and I must defend against him.
Johnston nodded. I do.
How do you advise me to arrange my forces in Castelgar?
My lord, Johnston said, I would not defend Castelgar at all.
Oh, why say you that?
Oliver went to the nearest table, took a goblet, and poured wine. How many soldiers did you require to take it from the Gascon? Johnston asked.
50 or 60, no more.
Then you are answered.
But we made no frontal attack. We used stealth, craft.
And the archpriest will not?
He may try, but we shall be waiting. We shall be prepared for his attack.
Perhaps, Johnston said, turning, and perhaps not.
So you are a cunning man.
No, my lord, I do not see the future. I have no such abilities at all. I merely give you my advice as a man. And I say the archpriest will be no less stealthy than you. Oliver frowned, drank in sullen silence for a while. Then he seemed to notice the chef, the boys holding the tray, all of them standing silent, and waved them away. As they departed, he said, "Take good care of that subtlety. I wish nothing to happen to it before the guests see it." In a few moments, they were alone again. He turned to Johnston, gestured to the tapestries, "Or to this castle." "My lord," Johnston said, "you have no need to defend this castle when you have another so much better."
"Eh? You speak of Laroque? But Laroque has a weakness. There is a passage that I cannot find."
"And how do you know the passage exists?"
"It must exist," Oliver said, "because old Laon was architect of Laroque. You know of Laon?" "No. He was the abbot of the monastery before the present abbot. That old bishop was crafty, and whenever he was called upon to give assistance rebuilding a town or a castle or a church, he left behind some secret known only to him. Every castle had an unknown passage or an unknown weakness, which Laon could sell to an attacker if need arose. Old Laon had a sharp eye for the interest of Mother Church, and a much sharper eye for himself."
"And yet," Johnston said, "if no one knows where this passage is, it might as well not exist." "There are other considerations, my lord. What is your present complement of soldiers here?"
220 men-at-arms, 250 bowsmen, and 200 pikemen."
"Arnaud has twice as many," Johnston said. "Perhaps more."
"Think you so?"
"Indeed, he is no better than a common thief, but now he is a famous thief, for marching on Avignon, requiring the pontiff to dine with his men, and then pay 10,000 livres to leave the town intact."
"Sooth?" Lord Oliver said, looking troubled. "I have not heard of this. Of course, there are rumors that Arnaud intends to march on Avignon, perhaps as soon as next month, and all presume he will threaten the Pope. But he has not done so yet."
He frowned.
"Has he?"
"You speak truth, my lord," the professor said promptly. "I meant to say that the daring of his intended plans draws new soldiers to his side every day. By now he has 1,000 in his company, perhaps 2,000.
Oliver snorted. "I am not afraid."
"I am sure you are not," Johnston said. "But this castle has a shallow moat, a single drawbridge, a single gateway arch, no deadfall, and a single portcullis. Your ramparts to the east are low. You have no space to store food and water for only a few days. Your garrison is cramped in the small courtyard, and your men not easily maneuverable."
Oliver said, "I tell you, my treasure is here, and I shall remain here with it."
"And my advice," Johnston said, "is to gather what you can and depart. Laroque is built on a cliff with sheer rock on two sides. It has a deep moat on the third side, two gateway doors, two portcullis, two drawbridges. Even if invaders manage to pass the outer gateway..."
"I know the virtues of Laroque."
Johnston paused, "and I do not wish to hear your damnable instruction." "As you will, Lord Oliver." And then Johnston said, "Ah."
"Ah? Ah?"
"My lord," Johnston said, "I cannot counsel if you circumstance to me."
"Circumstance? I do not circumstance, Magister."
"How many men have you garrisoned at Laroque?" Oliver squirmed uncomfortably.
300.
"So, your treasure is already at Laroque." Lord Oliver squinted. He said nothing. He turned, walked around Johnston, squinted again. Finally,
"You are pressing me to go there by provoking my fears."
"I am not."
"You want me to move to Laroque because you know that castle has a weakness. You are the creature of Arnaud, and you prepare the way for his assault."
"My lord," Johnston said, "if Laroque is inferior, as you say, why have you placed your treasure there?" Oliver snorted, again unhappy.
"You are clever with words."
"My lord, your own actions tell you which castle is superior."
"Very well. But, Magister, if I go to Laroque, you go with me. And if another finds that secret entrance before you have told me of it, I will myself see that you die in a way that will make
Edward's end. He cackled at his pun. Appear a kindness.
I take your meaning, Johnston said.
Do you? Then see you take it to heart.
Chris Hughes stared out the window. 60 feet below him, the courtyard lay in shadow. Men and women in their finery drifted toward the lighted windows of the great hall. He heard the faint sounds of music. The festive scene made him feel even more morose, more isolated. The three of them were going to be killed, and there was nothing they could do about it. They were locked in a small chamber, high in the central tower of the castle keep, overlooking the castle walls and the town beyond. This was a woman's room, with a spinning wheel and an altar off to one side, perfunctory signs of piety overwhelmed by the enormous bed, with red plush coverings and fur trim in the center of the room. The door to the room was of solid oak and fitted with a new lock. Sir Guy himself had locked the door, after placing one guard inside the room sitting by the door and two others outside. They were taking no chances this time. Merrick sat on the bed, staring into space, lost in thought. Or perhaps he was listening. He had one hand cupped around his ear. Meanwhile, Kate paced restlessly, moving from one window to the next, inspecting the view from each. At the farthest window, she leaned way out, looking down, then walked to the window where Chris was standing and leaned out again. The view here is just the same, Chris said. Her restlessness annoyed him. Then he saw she was reaching out to run her hand along the wall at the side of the window, feeling the stones and the mortar. He stared at her, questioning. Maybe, she said, nodding. Maybe. Chris reached out and touched the wall. The masonry was nearly smooth, the wall curving and sheer. It was a straight drop to the courtyard below. Are you joking? He said. No, she said. I'm not. He looked out again. In the courtyard, there were many others besides the courtiers. A group of squires talked and laughed as they cleaned the armor and groomed the horses of the knights. To the right, soldiers patrolled the parapet wall. Any of them could turn and look up if her movement caught their eye. You'll be seen.
From this window, yes. Not from the other. Our only problem is him.
She nodded toward the guard at the door.
Can you do anything to help?
Sitting on the bed, Merrick said, I'll take care of it.
What the hell is this? Chris said, very annoyed.
He spoke loudly.
You don't think I can do this myself?
No, I don't.
Damn it, I'm sick of the way you treat me.
Chris said. He was furious. Looking around for something to fight with, he picked up the little stool by the spinning wheel and started toward Merrick. The guard saw it, said, No, 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 quickly as he went toward Chris. He never saw Merrick hit him from behind with a metal candlestick. The guard crumpled, and Merrick caught him, eased him silently to the floor. Blood was pouring from the guard's head onto an oriental carpet.
Is he dead?
Chris said, staring at Merrick. Who cares? Merrick said. Just continue to talk quietly so the ones outside hear our voices. They looked over, but Kate had already gone out the window.
It's just a free solo, she told herself as she clung to the tower wall 60 feet in the air. The wind pulled at her, rippling her clothes. She gripped the slight protrusions of the mortar with her fingertips. Sometimes the mortar crumbled away and she had to grab, then grip again. But here and there she found indentations in the mortar, large enough for her occasional fingertips to fit in. She'd flashed more difficult climbs. Any number of buildings at Yale were more difficult, although there she'd always had chalk for her hands and proper climbing shoes and a safety rope. No safety here. It isn't far. She'd climbed out the west window because it was behind the guard, because it faced toward the town, and so she would be less likely to be seen from the courtyard below, and because it was the shortest distance to the next window, which stood at the end of the hallway that ran outside the chamber. It isn't far, she told herself. 10 feet at most. Don't rush it. No hurry. Just one hand, then a foothold. Another hand. Almost there, she thought. Almost there. Then she touched the stone windowsill. She got her first firm hand grip. She pulled herself up one-handed, then peered cautiously down the corridor. There were no guards. The hallway was empty. Using both hands now, Kate pulled up, flopped onto the ledge, and slid over onto the floor.
She was now standing in the hallway outside the locked door. Softly, she said, I made it.
Merrick said, guards? No, but no key either. She inspected the door. It was thick, solid. Merrick said, hinges? Yes, outside. They were made of heavy wrought iron. She knew what he was asking her. I can see the pins. If she could knock the pins out of the hinges, the door would be easy to break open. But I need a hammer or something. There's nothing here I can use. Find one, Merrick said softly. She ran down the corridor.
Decare, Lord Oliver said as the knight with the scar came into the room. The Magister counsels to remove to Laroc. Decare gave a judicious nod.
The risk would be grave, sire.
And the risk to stay here, Oliver said.
If the Magister's advice is true and good, and without other intent, why did his assistants conceal their identity when they first came to your court? Such concealment is not the mark of honesty, my lord. I would you be satisfied of their answer for this conduct, before I put faith in this new Magister and his advisements.
Let us all be satisfied, Oliver said. Bring the assistants to me now, and we shall ask them what you wish to know.
My lord, Decare bowed and left the room.
Kate came out of the stairwell and slipped into the crowd in the courtyard. She was thinking that she could use a carpenter's toolkit or a blacksmith's hammer, or maybe some of the tools the farrier used to shoe horses. Over to the left, she saw the grooms and the horses, and she started to drift in that direction. In the excited throng, nobody paid her any attention. She slipped easily toward the east wall and was beginning to consider how to distract the grooms when directly ahead she saw a knight standing very still and staring at her. Robert Decare. Their eyes met for a moment and then she turned and ran. From behind her she heard Decare shout for help and the answering cries from soldiers all around her. She pushed forward through the crowd, which was suddenly an impediment, hands clutching at her, plucking at her clothes. It was like a nightmare. To escape the crowd, she went through the nearest door, slamming it behind her. She found herself in the kitchen. The room was dreadfully hot and more crowded than the courtyard. Huge iron cauldrons boiled on fires in the enormous fireplace. A dozen capons turned on a row of spits, the crank turned by a child. She paused, uncertain what to do, and then Decare came through the door after her, hissed, "You!" and swung his sword. She ducked, scrambled among the tables of food being prepared. The sword crashed down, sending platters flying. She scrambled, crouched low beneath the tables. The cooks began to yell. She saw a giant model of the castle made in some kind of pastry and headed there. Decare was right after her. The cooks were shouting, "No, Sir Robert, no!" in a kind of chorus from all around the room, and some of the men were so distressed that they came forward to stop him. Decare swung again. She ducked, and the sword decapitated the castle battlements, raising a cloud of white powder. At this, the chefs gave a collective shriek of agony and fell on Decare from all sides, shouting that this was Lord Oliver's favorite, that he had approved it, that Sir Robert must not do further damage. Robert rolled on the floor, swearing and trying to shake them off. In the confusion, she ran back out the door again into the afternoon light. Off to the right, she saw the curved wall of the chapel. The chapel was undergoing some restoration. There was a ladder going up the wall and some perfunctory scaffolding on the roof where tilers were making repairs. She wanted to get away from the crowds and the soldiers. She knew that on the far side of the chapel, a narrow passage ran between the chapel building and the outer wall of the castle tower. At least she would be out of the crowd if she went there. As she ran toward the passage, she heard Decare behind her shouting to the soldiers. He had gotten out of the kitchen. She ran hard, trying to gain some distance. She rounded the corner of the chapel. Looking back, she saw other soldiers running the other way around the chapel, intending to head her off at the far end of the passage. Sir Robert barked more orders to the soldiers as he came around the corner after her, and then he stopped abruptly. The soldiers halted at his side, and everyone murmured in confusion. They stared down a passage 4 feet wide between the castle and the chapel. The passage was empty.
At the far end of the passage, other soldiers appeared, facing them. The woman had disappeared. Kate was clinging 10 feet up the chapel wall, the outline of her body concealed by the decorative border of the chapel window and thick vines of ivy. Even so, she was easily visible if anyone looked up. But the passage was dark, and no one did. She heard Decaire shout angrily, "Go to the other assistants and dispatch them now!" The soldiers hesitated. "But, Sir Robert, they assist the magister of Lord Oliver, and Lord Oliver himself commands it. Kill them all!" The soldiers ran off into the castle. Decaire swore. He was talking to a remaining soldier, but they were whispering, and her ear translator crackled and she couldn't make it out. In truth, she was surprised she had been able to hear as much as she had. How had she been able to hear them? It seemed as if they were too far away to hear Decaire so clearly. And yet his voice was clear, almost amplified. Maybe the acoustics of the passage. Glancing down, she saw soldiers hadn't left. They were just milling about, so she couldn't go back down. She decided to climb up onto the roof and wait until things were quieter. The roof of the chapel was still in sunlight, a plain peaked roof of tile with small gaps where repairs were being made. The pitch was steep. She crouched at the gutter and said, "Andre." A crackle. She thought she heard Merrick's voice, but the static was bad. "Andre, they're coming to kill you." There was no answer, just more static. "Andre?" No answer. Perhaps the walls around her were interfering with transmission. She might do better from the top of the roof. She began to climb the steep slope, easing around the tile repair sites. At each site, the mason had set up a small platform with his mortar basin and stack of tiles. The chirp of birds made her pause. She saw there was actually a hole in the roof at these tiling sites, and a scraping sound made her look up. She saw a soldier come over the top of the roof. He paused, peering down at her. Then a second soldier. So that was why Decaire had been whispering. He'd seen her after all, on the wall, and had sent soldiers up the ladder on the opposite side. She looked down and saw soldiers in the passage below. They were now staring up at her. Now the first soldier swung his leg over the ridge of the roof and was starting to come down toward her. There was only one thing she could do. The mason's hole was about 2 feet square. Through it she could see the bracing beneath the roof, and about 10 feet below that, the plaster arches of the chapel ceiling. There was a sort of wooden catwalk running over the plaster arches. Everything was covered in bird droppings. Kate crawled through the hole and dropped down to the ceiling below. She smelled the sour odor of dust and bird droppings. She saw there were nests everywhere along the flat walkways in the corners and joists. She ducked as a few sparrows flew past her head, chittering. And suddenly, she was engulfed in a swirling tornado of shrieking birds and flying feathers. There were hundreds in here, she realized, and she had disturbed them. For a moment she could do nothing except put her arms over her face and stand quietly. The sounds lessened. When she looked again, there were only a few flying birds, and the two soldiers were climbing down through holes in the roof to the ground below. Quickly she moved down the walkway to a far door which probably led into the church. As she approached it, the door opened and a third soldier came through, 3 against 1. She backed away, moving along the walkway that went over the curves of the ceiling domes. But the other soldiers were moving toward her. They had taken their daggers out. She had no illusions about what they intended. She backed away. She remembered how she had hung beneath this ceiling, examining the many breaks and repairs that had been made over the centuries. Now she was standing above that same structure. The walkway clearly implied the plaster curves were weak. How weak? Would they support her weight? The men were moving steadily toward her. She stepped out onto one of the domes gingerly, testing it. She put her full weight on it. It held. The soldiers were coming after her, but moving slowly. The birds suddenly were active again, shrieking and rising like a cloud. The soldiers covered their faces. The sparrows flew so close that their wings beat at her face. She moved backward again, her feet crunching on the thick layer of accumulated droppings. She was now standing on a surface of curved plaster, a series of domes, with thick plaster ribs, where the arches met in the center. She moved toward the ribs because she knew they would be structurally stronger, and walking on them, she made her way toward the far end of the chapel, where she saw a little door. This would probably take her down the interior of the church, perhaps coming down behind an altar. One of the soldiers ran along the walkway and then stepped out on the bulge of the curving arch. He moved to block her progress. He held his knife in front of him.